Chapter 46. Alan Burley, King Harry, Part the First. We now come to King Henry VIII, whom it has been too much the fashion to call Bluff King Al, apostrophe and Burley King Harry, and other fine names, but whom I shall take the liberty to call, plainly, one of the most detestable villains that ever drew breath. You will be able to judge, long before we come to the end of his life, whether he deserves the character. He was just 18 years of age when he came to the throne. People said he was handsome then, but I don't believe it. He was a big, burly, noisy, small-eyed, large-faced, double-chinned, swinish-looking fellow in later life, as we know from the likenesses of him, painted by the famous Hans Holbein, and it is not easy to believe that so bad a character can ever have been veiled under a prepossessing appearance. He was anxious to make himself popular, and the people, who had long disliked the late king, were very willing to believe that he deserved to be so. He was extremely fond of show and display, and so were they. Therefore there was great rejoicing when he married the Princess Catherine, and when they were both crowned. And the king fought at tournaments, and always came off victorious, for the courtiers took care of that, and there was a general outcry that he was a wonderful man. Empson, Dudley, and their supporters were accused of a variety of crimes they had never committed, instead of the offenses of which they really had been guilty, and they were pilloried, and set upon horses with their faces to the tails, and knocked about and beheaded, to the satisfaction of the people, and the enrichment of the king. The Pope, so indefatigable in getting the world into trouble, had mixed himself up in a war on the continent of Europe, occasioned by the reigning princes of little quarreling states in Italy having at various times married into other royal families, and so led to their claiming a share in those petty governments. The king, who discovered that he was very fond of the Pope, sent a herald to the king of France, to say that he must not make war upon that holy personage, because he was the father of all Christians. As the French king did not mind this relationship in the least, and also refused to admit a claim King Henry made to certain lands in France, war was declared between the two countries. Not to perplex this story with an account of the tricks and designs of all the sovereigns who were engaged in it, it is enough to say that England made a blundering alliance with Spain, and got stupidly taken in by that country, which made its own terms with France when it could, and left England in the lurch. Sir Edward Howard, a bold admiral, son of the Earl of Surrey, distinguished himself by his bravery against the French in this business. But, unfortunately, he was more brave than wise, for, skimming into the French harbor of Brest with only a few rowboats, he attempted, in revenge for the defeat and death of Sir Thomas Knyvet, another bold English admiral, to take some strong French ships, well defended with batteries of cannon. The upshot was that he was left on board of one of them in consequence of its shooting away from his own boat, with not more than about a dozen men, and was thrown into the sea and drowned. Though not until he had taken from his breast his gold chain and gold whistle, which were the signs of his office, and had cast them into the sea, to prevent their being made a boast of by the enemy. After this defeat, which was a great one, for Sir Edward Howard was a man of valor and fame, the king took it into his head to invade France in person, first executing that dangerous Earl of Suffolk whom his father had left in the Tower, and appointing Queen Catherine to the charge of his kingdom in his absence. He sailed to Calais, where he was joined by Maximilian, Emperor of Germany, who pretended to be his soldier, and who took pay in his service. With a good deal of nonsense of that sort, flattering enough to the vanity of a vain blusterer. The king might be successful enough in sham fights, but his idea of real battles chiefly consisted in pitching silken tents of bright colors, that were ignominiously blown down by the wind, and in making a vast display of gaudy flags and golden curtains. Fortune, however, favored him better than he deserved. 4. After much waste of time in tent pitching, flag flying, gold curtaining, and other such masquerading, he gave the French battle at a place called Guinegate, where they took such an unaccountable panic, and fled with such swiftness, that it was ever afterwards called by the English the Battle of Spurs. Instead of following up his advantage, the king, finding that he had had enough of real fighting, came home again. The Scottish king, though nearly related to Henry by marriage, had taken part against him in this war. The Earl of Surrey, as the English general, advanced to meet him when he came out of his own dominions and crossed the River Tweed. The two armies came up with one another when the Scottish king had also crossed the River Till and was encamped upon the last of the Cheviot Hills, called the Hill of Flodden. Along the plain below it, the English, when the hour of battle came, advanced. The Scottish army, which had been drawn up in five great bodies, then came steadily down in perfect silence. So they, in their turn, advanced to meet the English army, which came on in one long line, and they attacked it with a body of spearmen, under Lord Home. At first they had the best of it. But the English recovered themselves so bravely, and fought with such valor, that, when the Scottish king had almost made his way up to the royal standard, he was slain, and the whole Scottish power routed. 10,000 Scottish men lay dead, that day on Flodden Field, and among them, numbers of the nobility and gentry. For a long time afterwards, the Scottish peasantry used to believe that their king had not been really killed in this battle, because no Englishman had found an iron belt he wore about his body as a penance for having been an unnatural and undutiful son. But, whatever became of his belt, the English had his sword and dagger, and the ring from his finger, and his body too, covered with wounds. There is no doubt of it, for it was seen and recognized by English gentlemen who had known the Scottish king well. When King Henry was making ready to renew the war in France, the French king was contemplating peace. His queen, dying at this time, he proposed, though he was upwards of 50 years old, to marry King Henry's sister, the Princess Mary, who, besides being only 16, was betrothed to the Duke of Suffolk. As the inclinations of young princesses were not much considered in such matters, the marriage was concluded, and the poor girl was escorted to France, where she was immediately left as the French king's bride, with only one of all her English attendants. That one was a pretty young girl named Anne Boleyn, niece of the Earl of Surrey, who had been made Duke of Norfolk after the victory of Flodden Field. Anne Boleyn's is a name to be remembered, as you will presently find. And now the French king, who was very proud of his young wife, was preparing for many years of happiness, and she was looking forward, I dare say, to many years of misery, when he died within 3 months, and left her a young widow. The new French monarch, Francis I, seeing how important it was to his interests that she should take for her second husband no one but an Englishman, advised her first lover, the Duke of Suffolk, when King Henry sent him over to France to fetch her home, to marry her. The princess being herself so fond of that duke, as to tell him that he must either do so then, or forever lose her, they were wedded, and Henry afterwards forgave them. In making interest with the king, the Duke of Suffolk had addressed his most powerful favorite and adviser, Thomas Wolsey, a name very famous in history for its rise and downfall. Wolsey was the son of a respectable butcher at Ipswich, in Suffolk, and received so excellent an education that he became a tutor to the family of the Marquis of Dorset, who afterwards got him appointed one of the late king's chaplains. On the accession of Henry VIII, he was promoted and taken into great favor. He was now Archbishop of York, the Pope had made him a cardinal besides, and whoever wanted influence in England or favor with the king, whether he were a foreign monarch or an English nobleman, was obliged to make a friend of the great Cardinal Wolsey. He was a gay man, who could dance and jest, and sing and drink, and those were the roads to so much, or rather so little, of a heart as King Henry had. He was wonderfully fond of pomp and glitter, and so was the king. He knew a good deal of the church learning of that time, much of which consisted in finding artful excuses and pretenses for almost any wrong thing, and in arguing that black was white, or any other color. This kind of learning pleased the king too. For many such reasons, the cardinal was high in estimation with the king, and, being a man of far greater ability, knew as well how to manage him, as a clever keeper may know how to manage a wolf or a tiger, or any other cruel and uncertain beast, that may turn upon him, and tear him any day. Never had there been seen in England such state as my Lord Cardinal kept. His wealth was enormous, equal, it was reckoned, to the riches of the crown. His palaces were as splendid as the king's, and his retinue was 800 strong. He held his court, dressed out from top to toe in flaming scarlet, and his very shoes were golden, set with precious stones. His followers rode on blood horses, while he, with a wonderful affectation of humility in the midst of his great splendor, ambled on a mule with a red velvet saddle and bridle and golden stirrups. Through the influence of this stately priest, a grand meeting was arranged to take place between the French and English kings in France, but on ground belonging to England. A prodigious show of friendship and rejoicing was to be made on the occasion, and heralds were sent to proclaim with brazen trumpets through all the principal cities of Europe, that, on a certain day, the kings of France and England, as companions and brothers in arms, each attended by 18 followers, would hold a tournament against all knights who might choose to come. Charles, the new emperor of Germany, the old one being dead, wanted to prevent too cordial an alliance between these sovereigns, and came over to England before the king could repair to the place of meeting, and, besides making an agreeable impression upon him, secured Wolsey's interest by promising that his influence should make him pope when the next vacancy occurred. On the day when the emperor left England, the king and all the court went over to Calais, and thence to the place of meeting, between Arders and Gisnes, commonly called the Field of the Cloth of Gold. Here, all manner of expense and prodigality was lavished on the decorations of the show, many of the knights and gentlemen being so superbly dressed that it was said they carried their whole estates upon their shoulders. There were sham castles, temporary chapels, fountains running wine, great cellars full of wine free as water to all comers, silk tents, gold lace and foil, gilt lions, and such things without end. And, in the midst of all, the rich cardinal outshone, and outglittered all the noblemen and gentlemen assembled. After a treaty made between the two kings with as much solemnity as if they had intended to keep it, the lists 900 feet long and 320 broad were opened for the tournament, the queens of France and England looking on with great array of lords and ladies. Then, for 10 days, the two sovereigns fought 5 combats every day, and always beat their polite adversaries, though they do write that the King of England, being thrown in a wrestle one day by the King of France, lost his kingly temper with his brother in arms, and wanted to make a quarrel of it. Then, there is a great story belonging to this Field of the Cloth of Gold, showing how the English were distrustful of the French, and the French of the English, until Francis rode alone one morning to Henry's tent, and, going in before he was out of bed, told him in joke that he was his prisoner, and how Henry jumped out of bed and embraced Francis, and how Francis helped Henry to dress, and warmed his linen for him, and how Henry gave Francis a splendid jeweled collar, and how Francis gave Henry, in return, a costly bracelet. All this and a great deal more was so written about, and sung about, and talked about at that time, and, indeed, since that time too, that the world has had good cause to be sick of it, forever. Of course, nothing came of all these fine doings, but a speedy renewal of the war between England and France, in which the two royal companions and brothers-in-arms longed very earnestly to damage one another. But, before it broke out again, the Duke of Buckingham was shamefully executed on Tower Hill, on the evidence of a discharged servant really for nothing, except the folly of having believed in a friar of the name of Hopkins, who had pretended to be a prophet, and who had mumbled and jumbled out some nonsense about the Duke's son being destined to be very great in the land. It was believed that the unfortunate Duke had given offense to the great cardinal by expressing his mind freely about the expense and absurdity of the whole business of the field of the cloth of gold. At any rate, he was beheaded, as I have said, for nothing. And the people who saw it done were very angry, and cried out that it was the work of the butcher's son. The new war was a short one, though the Earl of Surrey invaded France again, and did some injury to that country. It ended in another treaty of peace between the two kingdoms, and in the discovery that the Emperor of Germany was not such a good friend to England in reality, as he pretended to be. Neither did he keep his promise to Wolsey to make him pope, though the king urged him. Two popes died in pretty quick succession, but the foreign priests were too much for the cardinal, and kept him out of the post. So the cardinal and king together found out that the Emperor of Germany was not a man to keep faith with, broke off a projected marriage between the king's daughter Mary, Princess of Wales, and that sovereign, and began to consider whether it might not be well to marry the young lady, either to Francis himself, or to his eldest son. There now arose at Wittenberg, in Germany, the great leader of the mighty change in England which is called the Reformation, and which set the people free from their slavery to the priests. This was a learned doctor, named Martin Luther, who knew all about them, for he had been a priest, and even a monk, himself. The preaching and writing of Wycliffe had set a number of men thinking on this subject, and Luther, finding one day to his great surprise, that there really was a book called the New Testament which the priests did not allow to be read, and which contained truths that they suppressed, began to be very vigorous against the whole body, from the Pope downward. It happened, while he was yet only beginning his vast work of awakening the nation, that an impudent fellow named Tetzel, a friar of very bad character, came into his neighborhood selling what were called indulgences, by wholesale, to raise money for beautifying the great cathedral of St. Peter's, at Rome. Whoever bought an indulgence of the Pope was supposed to buy himself off from the punishment of heaven for his offenses. Luther told the people that these indulgences were worthless bits of paper before God, and that Tetzel and his masters were a crew of impostors in selling them. The king and the cardinal were mightily indignant at this presumption, and the king, with the help of Sir Thomas More, a wise man, whom he afterwards repaid by striking off his head, even wrote a book about it, with which the Pope was so well pleased that he gave the king the title of Defender of the Faith. The king and the cardinal also issued flaming warnings to the people not to read Luther's books, on pain of excommunication. But they did read them for all that, and the rumor of what was in them spread far and wide. When this great change was thus going on, the king began to show himself in his truest and worst colors. Anne Boleyn, the pretty little girl who had gone abroad to France with his sister, was by this time grown up to be very beautiful, and was one of the ladies in attendance on Queen Catherine. Now, Queen Catherine was no longer young or handsome, and it is likely that she was not particularly good-tempered, having been always rather melancholy, and having been made more so by the deaths of four of her children, when they were very young. So, the king fell in love with the fair Anne Boleyn, and said to himself, "How can I be best rid of my own troublesome wife whom I am tired of, and marry Anne?" You recollect that Queen Catherine had been the wife of Henry's brother. What does the king do, after thinking it over, but calls his favorite priests about him, and says, oh, his mind is in such a dreadful state, and he is so frightfully uneasy, because he is. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.